I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
The next chapter.
To be able to make something that wasn't there yesterday.
As my friends like to say, sort of my alter ego.
The refusal to connect to Haiti on the grounds of culture and race.
The next chapter.
On CBC Radio 1.
And Sirius XM.
The headlines from Haiti in the past weeks have been grim. It's a country with a devastating history that Miriam J.A. Chancy knows well. She was born there and grew up moving between Port-au-Prince and Canada. When she recalls her childhood, it's not the strife that comes to mind, but the beauty of the country and its people. Her novels go behind the headlines to show how the country's history and trauma move through the lives of people. Miriam's latest novel, Village Weavers, is the story of lifelong friends who meet as girls in Port-au-Prince. And in a half an hour from now, our contributor Ryan B. Patrick speaks with Miriam about Village Weavers. To close the program, Tom Wilson answers the Proust questionnaire. Tom is a creative force, a well-known musician, writer, and artist. A few years ago, he wrote about his late-in-life discovery of his Mohawk identity. It was something hidden from him as an adopted child. Tom's latest book is a collection of his artwork titled Mohawk Warriors, Hunters, and Chiefs. But first, Sonia Lally, a.k.a. S.C. Lally, on her two names and two writerly identities. I'm Ali Hassan. Welcome to the next chapter. Last summer, I was in Moose Jaw for the Saskatchewan Festival of Words. And one night I heard S.C. Lally, a.k.a. Sonia Lally, read from the first chapter of Are You Sarah? It's a book about a murder investigation stemming from an Uber ride gone wrong. It was immersive and a little bit creepy, and I was hooked. So much so that I wanted to talk with Sonia about it and all her other writing. And there is a lot of it. Sonia is also the author of five romance novels. Her latest is Jasmine and Jake Rock the Boat, and it follows a woman who goes on a cruise to Alaska to deal with the fallout of a breakup. All of her books feature South Asian women navigating love, family conflict, and cultural expectations. I'm happy to say Sonia joins me now from Vancouver. Hi, Sonia. Welcome to the next chapter.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Well, you have published six books so far, and you have a background in law. Without bragging too much, can you tell us a bit about that? And what did you have in mind when you turned to writing fiction?
Sure. I won't brag at all. So essentially, I studied law in my hometown of Saskatoon in Saskatchewan. And although I love that journey, there was always a part of me that wanted to write and tell stories and share my experiences and the experiences of my family and the people I grew up with. So I started writing seriously about 10 years ago in my mid-20s. And it was that time when I was asking a lot of questions about who am I? What do I want in this world? What is my purpose? And what do I want my life to look like with a partner? And those questions I put in my writing, and that ended up being perfect material for a romance novel. Hmm. And so that's sort of where that journey all started.
And romance novels, you know, they have love and happy endings. They are very different from crime and suspense, which you find in thriller. So how do you get the inspiration for each style?
Right. So in my romance novels, essentially, each protagonist is going on this self-love journey, figuring themselves out. And as you said, navigating sort of their family and the cultural expectations. So that's sort of where all that material comes from. In thrillers, it was a very, very different approach. I started writing Are You Sarah in the early pandemic when my headspace did not allow me to sort of really think about happily ever afters. I wasn't confident that there was going to be a happily ever after for my characters or for society more generally. And that sort of headspace is where I was when I started writing Are You Sarah? And it simply was that I had an idea for that book, and it felt like sort of the perfect time to explore that darker side of me, or as my friends like to say, sort of my alter ego.
Hmm. Would you say you have now made the switch to thrillers, or do you still go back and forth depending on what mood or what headspace you're in?
Well, I hope to keep writing in both genres as long as they let me. I think I'm able to sort of explore two different sides of myself to tell two different, very different stories. So I hope to keep going in both.
And I mentioned that you have a background in law. Do you practice law anymore?
No, I don't. I articled and then I haven't been back since.
And I asked you in Moose Jaw if your law, the law background informed the fiction that you write. And I'm going to ask you that again. Does it?
Sure.
Is the crime and suspense, was your law, a law background something that could help you write thrillers?
I think in terms of the craft, the analytical approach to law and legal thinking, the critical thinking, I do think that really helped me develop my sort of approach to writing. And I'm a very process-driven person, so I think that way of thinking helped my craft. In terms of what I actually learned in law school, I hate to say it, but I don't think I've applied that much. Are You Sarah features, the protagonist is a law student. So I definitely brought in some of my own experiences from that. But that's probably the limit.
I have an MBA and I'm hosting a literature show. So I can relate to what you're saying. Some of these degrees don't follow you into your next journeys. I mentioned that, I'm talking to Sonia Lali, but there's the AKA here because you also write under SC Lali. Writing as two different people, do you ever have trouble separating the two writing personas? Do people struggle with that?
I think that I purposely kept those two sort of names, brands, however you want to call it, separate at the beginning, partly because I was not confident that the thriller would be anything, that it was something that I wanted to pursue. And so I wanted to keep that separate. But now I like to see it as two sides of myself. It's not a secret that I'm SC Lali and want to write about murder and darker themes. And it's not a secret that I'm also a romance writer and want to, tell love stories, too.
So originally you had SC Lali as a name that you could easily dispose of if things didn't go well in the thriller world. Is that what
yes,
I'm keeping
that, in? Yes, that was the plan, yes.
But then your overachievement follows you into the thriller genre as well. So congrats on that.
Oh, thank you.
Coming up with a story that shows the darker side of humanity, like Are You Sarah does. In Are You Sarah, we have one Bengali woman named Saraswati, who is Sarah, and then we have one white American woman named Sarah, and they meet before mistakenly getting in each other's Uber rides. Saraswati finds that the other Sarah is dead in front of her door, and these two women are both named Sarah. That they have that in common, but they're very different people. Can you tell us about those differences, why you wanted to contrast them?
Sure. So the whole story revolves around, which Sarah was supposed to die. And the surviving Sarah, Saraswati, spends the whole book wondering if she was the intent and target, if someone's still after her and is racked with guilt over the death of the other Sarah. I really liked, separate from the plot, the duality of them. Saraswati is, she's Indian. She doesn't come from much. She has to hustle for everything that she has. Sarah Ellis, on the other hand, comes from a lot of privilege. She has squandered a lot of her opportunities. In a lot of ways, these two women are polar opposites. But at the same time, as you sort of read the book, you discover that these two women are also very, very similar. They're both looking for something outside of themselves to feel whole. And although their methods may be misguided, at the end of the day, they were very, very similar women too. So I loved exploring those two different women and sort of what happened to them and what could have happened to them.
Hmm. All right, let's talk about romance now. Jasmine and Jake rock the boat. To heal her broken heart, Jasmine heads off on an Alaskan cruise, I mentioned, out of the gate. Why an Alaskan cruise?
You know, so for my romances, the origin story of each of them before Jasmine and Jake rock the boat was sort of a character or a concept. But for this book, actually, the Alaskan cruise, that setting in particular was what sparked the idea. And that's because I went on an Alaskan cruise with my whole family about 15 years ago, sort of three generations of the Lally family, setting sail along the Pacific. And I think I must have always thought that that would be such a beautiful and complicated place to explore a love story and a family story. I remember the first day that we embarked on the cruise, my grandparents told us all to go explore on our own because they were going to have a rest. And then lo and behold, a few hours later, we caught them out for a stroll holding hands. They ditched us. Mm-hmm. You know, they wanted to have their romance alone on that cruise. And so I think that always stayed with me and sort of gave me material for later.
You explore this idea of the, quote, good Indian girl, good Indian boy. That often comes up, both in Jasmine and Jake Rock the Boat and in Are You Sarah? What does that concept mean to you?
I think good Indian girl is something that has always, that I think a lot of us have grown up with. And it means, you know, a girl within our culture who follows the rules, who meets the expectations of her family, of her community, who doesn't step out of line, who doesn't bring shame or embarrassment. And it's something that I think a lot of us want to follow, but it also feels very constraining sometimes because what is good sometimes in our social situation is very different than the world that we're growing up in. And sometimes I think the experiences of myself and a lot of us is we just want to go and do normal things in our society that would not be normal and are not looked upon well within our community. And so that's something that I explored in different ways in these books. In Jasmine and Jake Rock the Boat, Jasmine has gone out and made some decisions and personal choices that have brought shame on her family, that have given her a bad reputation, unfortunately. And so I wanted to play with that idea and contrast it to Jake, who never had a bad reputation, even though he made a lot of those same choices. In the same vein with Are You Sarah, I wanted to explore this idea of the good Indian girl, Saraswati, the main character. To all outward eyes, she is a very good Indian girl. She's gone to law school. She's making her parents proud. You know, she follows the book. But actually, she's not. And, you know, and as you go through the book, you sort of discover who she really is and all that she hides. And so it was just sort of a different perspective to that same concept.
Yeah, in Are You Sarah, we find out that Saraswati is, you know, hiding things from her parents. Why do you enjoy exploring that idea of a double life?
I think it's something that a lot of people live. A lot of young women in our community do have to do. I'm not saying everyone, and I'm certainly not saying that I had that double life, but it was really fun to explore that because the idea of code switching and having to be one person in front of a certain group of people and a completely different person in front of a different group of people. And sort of it begs the question, like, which person am I really, or can I be both? So I really loved exploring that in the thriller.
This idea of pressure that characters face from cultural expectations, that's very intense and hard to manage. Why is it important to you to write about that?
I think it's because it's something that so many of us go through in so many different and nuanced ways, in different magnitudes, across generations, across cultures. It's certainly not something that only South Asians experience. And especially when my first few romances were coming out, I received a lot of messages from people across ethnicities and different backgrounds saying that my story resonated with them. And so, I mean, if one of my books could even sort of resonate with anybody, that's beautiful and amazing. And so that's why I seek to do this.
And also your characters, while they're South Asian, I think most, if not all, also grow up here and have a connection to Canada, right? And they're part of tight-knit communities, but grow up as Canadians. What does that dynamic open up for you in terms of writing?
Yeah, so I think that I try and stick to and write with my own experience. I was born in Canada. I was raised in Canada. I grew up in a household where my parents spoke different languages, practiced different faiths, came from different parts of India. And so that sort of confusion was hard sometimes and beautiful in other ways. And I think that everybody in the diaspora has such a unique experience, but also a very universal experience of what's that like.
Mm. You know, when I met you, I joked about you sort of being a machine, and I've joked about your overachievement, but I do want to go through this. You have written, in 10 years, you have written 6 romance novels. Is that right?
Five. I'm working on my 6th, yeah.
No pressure. Oh, my God. This is the pressure. This is the South Asian pressure that we talk about. These are the cultural expectations that you have to fight off. So 6th romance novel is in the works. And how many thrillers do you have?
So Are You Sarah is the only one I've published. But then my 2nd thriller, The Plus One, is coming out this summer.
In August, if I'm
August,
correct.
August, yes. Right.
All right. We'll look forward to that. And I can't recommend Are You Sarah enough to people. Thank you so much, Sonia.
Thank you.
Sonia Lally, a.k.a. S.C. Lally, is the author of Are You Sarah and Jasmine and Jake Rock the Boat. She spoke with me from Vancouver.
Hey, it's Jeremy Albino. I'm a musician and songwriter from Scarborough, Ontario. And right now I'm reading How to Write One Song by Jeff Tweedy. It is about songwriting and finding a creative process, and it encapsulates the struggles that we all kind of go through maybe writing. My friend was reading it and he said, you should read it. And I had never really read any books about songwriting or anything like that. And when I did start reading it, I just fell in love with it. It's just validated a lot of what I was kind of going through as a songwriter. The topics that it touches on is just the process of writing, trying to find like a rhythm in all you're doing and how to kind of build a system, whereas songwriting has always kind of been like a mystical thing. Some people see it as a mystical thing, but if you really break it down, it can be something really fun and doable. This book really helped me find myself as a songwriter. I always really had a struggle with writing. I always found it really hard and kind of a really big uphill battle. And as I kind of evolved as a songwriter just by practice and co-writing is when I kind of really realized, oh, it isn't always a struggle and it isn't always a dreadful battle, which sometimes is what I would feel when I was writing. So that's why I think I really love this book, is just because it was like, oh, wow, this is what I am going through right now. And it validated me being like, wow, I really am doing all right. I would definitely recommend this book. I've also already recommended it to a bunch of people. There's like a lot of pressure when you're creating, I think, sometimes when it's kind of your business and trying to find ways to make it fun still and not so serious. It'll just open your eyes, I think, and hopefully you'll be able to write one song out of it.
Dorothy Ellen Palmer is an accessibility advocate, a writer, and a retired teacher. Her memoir, Falling for Myself, makes a passionate case for disability justice, and she's an award-winning writer on that subject. Dorothy lives in Burlington and uses a scooter she's named Rosie. And her most recent book is for children, and it's called The Scooter Twins. Here is Dorothy Ellen Palmer to tell us about it.
It's something I've always wanted to do, and something that I felt very strongly about doing after reading an article in the Toronto Star back in 2020, where Deborah Dundas had done a survey and discovered that disabled kids were the least represented in children's literature of all of the different marginalized groups. I wanted to have fun and I wanted to close that gap. The twins in the Scooter Twins came from the best possible source. Melvin and Melanie are modeled on my own two children, Connor and Severin. Melanie, like my daughter, is outspoken and feisty and very, very strong-willed. Melvin, like my son Connor, is a little more retiring, a little more thoughtful, less likely to speak up, more introspective, more shy. And it was also very gratifying to me that my kids, now fully grown, recognize themselves in that portrayal. On their birthday, they go to the doctor on their 8th birthday. And Melanie and Melvin discover that Dr. Singh is recommending mobility scooters, particularly for the long walk they're facing to school. And Melvin is very, very concerned about this. He is worried that he'll fall off. He's worried how he will look. He's worried that people will laugh or point fingers. Melanie is extremely excited because she hopes that it will keep her from being left behind, which is one of the things that she hates the most. And again, the contrast there between the two of them is very clear. And I also think represents the range that any kind of disabled kids might feel themselves if they are looking for their own new first scooters. My mobility scooter is named Rosie. She's red. She has been a lifesend to me because she gets me in and out of a lot of places. I live in Burlington, right downtown Burlington. It is a huge improvement to being able to get out in the world. And that's the same kind of exciting opportunity that I wanted to give the Scooter Twins. I've been faced with every attitude in the book about my scooter. Some people just smile. Some people are very curious, come up and ask questions because they want one for themselves or a family member, right up to very dirty looks, to people swearing at me, calling me names, that I'm lazy and fat. And if I lost some weight, I wouldn't need a scooter. I don't know where they got their medical degree, but they seem to feel that they could comment on my disability if I only got more exercise, yada, yada, yada. So it runs the full gamut of respectful interactions right down to open ableist insult. So I think it's really important to assert that a mobility scooter is just as necessary a piece of medical equipment as many people's pairs of glasses are necessary medical equipment. And when they are prescribed scooters, it is very clear that they're going to have to sell some of their mother's paintings to afford the scooters. Even in Canada, scooters, if you're lucky enough to get them partially funded by the government, you would still have to pay quite a bit. And for families living hand to mouth, as grandma and the twins live, it is a significant expense. Somewhere in the neighborhood of $2,000 each is a rough ballpark, but they can be as much as $6,000, depending on all the bells and whistles. The illustrator, the fabulous Maria Sweeney, also has a similar disability to myself and to the twins. That meant that the book is the creation, the fusion of a disabled author and a disabled illustrator. And I think that is really what has created the magic of the Scooter Twins.
That was Dorothy Ellen Palmer talking about her children's book, The Scooter Twins. It's illustrated by Maria Sweeney. We'll be back after these messages.
I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of 6 darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. You understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Carly Baker, author of Last Woman, and you're listening to The Next Chapter on CBC Radio 1.
Miriam J.A. Chancy was born into a large family in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. During her childhood, she went back and forth between Haiti and Canada. She grew up very rooted in the culture and politics of the country, and her parents kept a strong connection. That deep relationship underpins both her academic writing and her novels. Village Weavers is her fifth novel, and it follows a friendship between two Haitian girls as they grow up, go to France, the Dominican Republic, and finally the U.S. Our contributor Ryan B. Patrick spoke with Miriam Chancy.
Miriam, hello. Welcome to the next chapter. How are you?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
So tell me about the type of nation that Haiti was at the start of your novel.
Yeah, so I take the reader back to the 1940s to meet the two main characters, Cece and Gertie, in a Haiti that is really flourishing, that is a cultural mecca. You know, they hold the International World Expo and people come from all over. There are pavilions, and it's a very vibrant, alive space that has international recognition at this time.
So we can't mention Haiti without mentioning the Dominican Republic. I can't remember how old I was when I learned they were on the same island. It kind of blew my mind. But it also speaks to how that's kind of underplayed in terms of the beauty of Haiti compared to the popular perception of the nation today. Tell me about the real divisions between the nations and how that plays out in your book.
Well, the divisions are deep, and they're in some ways unfortunate because the Haitian Revolution liberated both sides of the island simultaneously. And in fact, resistors, formerly enslaved Africans and free people on both sides of the island were working towards that revolution. But because the two sides were colonized by different European entities, Spain versus France, what could be gained from freedom was different in terms of the relationship to the metropole. And then that informed the kinds of fissures that occurred from the 1800s on between Dominicans and Haitians. And then by the 1930s, we have a rise of Trujillo and Blanqueamiento, which meant the whitening of a nation, and a kind of a refusal to connect to Haiti on the grounds of culture and race. And so what it informs in the novel is a relationship between these two girls who find out that they have a connection to the Dominican Republic through a relative who is Haitian of Dominican descent, which is unusual. And they will have to grapple with what that might mean to them as they grow into adulthood.
So there's a lot to unpack there. Birds and bird imagery, Village Weaver, play a huge part in this book. Why is that?
Yeah, so the Village Weaver is a bird that I don't know if it's familiar to Canadians, but is a bird that creates nests, usually hanging from trees in the Caribbean from palm trees, creating their nests from fronds. And the Village Weaver of the title, who's also echoed somewhat in the epigraph, which goes back to Genesis, is the male bird. And the male bird creates, first it starts a nest, you know, during nesting season. And then once that nest is occupied, it creates multiple other nests. And each time one is occupied, it creates another one. So basically you have one male bird with multiple nests. And so this Village Weaver becomes emblematic in the novel of the father figure that informs the novel. But I was more interested in who occupies those nests and then the kind of village network that is created through those multiple nests that are interconnected on the same tree, but maybe not connected in terms of that father figure.
So there is definitely a lot to unpack here, Miriam. So Village Weavers is a story essentially about two young Haitian girls, Simone and Gertrude. You mentioned Cece and Gertie as they're known. They meet at school one fateful day, and they're forever connected through the decades that follow. They're at the opposite ends of the social and economic ladder, but yet they're drawn to each other. Tell me about their friendship.
Yeah, I think we can all think back to when we were in grade school and the kinds of friendships that we formed then that don't really have a rhyme or reason. You're just attracted to another kid in the, you know, classroom or the school ground. So this is what happens to Cece and Gertie. They have an automatic bond that they create just upon sight. And they slowly build that, you know, or very clear, actually very quickly build it the way kids do. And then they both find out a family secret that tears them apart. Or others who know about the family secret keep them apart. And it takes them a lifetime to figure out why that secret was so implosive and what it means to remain connected to each other despite that family secret. Mm.
So I don't want to reveal too much and reveal that family secret, but talking about Cece, she's known as an outside child. It means born out of wedlock. And with the status that term implies, who is Cece's support system at the beginning of the book?
Yeah, so Cece is raised in a family of women. The book opens with Momo telling her a story about the Simbi, goddesses or gods of the rivers in Haiti, and to really think about the connection she makes in life. But she's also teaching her about the connections that they have made in the family. So Cece is being raised with her older sister, Marguerite, and also with her mother. And her mother is a seamstress, and her grandmother, Momo, is a market woman. And so Momo is telling her this folklore story to imbue in her this idea that she doesn't have to necessarily think about marriage or a helpmate, but think about how women specifically are connected to one another and support one another in the way they do in their little family.
So you mentioned the Simbi. I want to touch on that, but let's give Gertie her full due. She's the other half of this equation. She seems to have it all. She comes from wealth, from a large family, but yet she still feels alone. Why is that?
So she is in a very wealthy family, and she's, you know, as we were talking about Cece being the outside child, she is an inside child. So she is, you know, considered legitimate and has the privileges of that status. She also has class status, but she's the youngest child in a very large family. She's a favored child, at least the older siblings consider her to be a favored child or doted upon. But she's also of darker skin. So colorism is part of the equation here, where the older siblings discriminate against her because of her color. And what she will come to learn is that that color is related to an inheritance that goes back, you know, hundreds of years to African ancestors that the older siblings deny. So part of what's at play in the novel is how color and class is negotiated on both sides of the border, both in the Dominican Republic and in Haiti, and how even with class status, it can sometimes be something that is used against individuals in terms of, you know, what is expected for their future.
So swirling around all this juicy family dynamics is the Simbi. It's infused with the spirits and spirituality rooted in African traditions, Haitian traditions. Tell me more about the Simbi and what the Simbi represent to these characters.
Yeah, so the Simbi are gods or goddesses of the rivers, and they are believed to both inhabit those waterways and also guide one tributary to another. So a river to the ocean, waterfalls to rivers, and so forth. And they're symbolic of the union of those waterways, one to the other. And so in the novel, what I attempt to do through that symbolism is to think about how the characters are connected one to the other, and that that is not necessarily a question of blood, but a question of how one is spiritually connected to others, or the willingness to be connected to others the way water is connected to water.
Mm. So how is this spirituality analogous to like Christianity? I'm fascinated by like the voodoo and Haitian culture, and it's kind of depicted or seen as mysticism and stuff like that compared to traditional Catholicism or Christianity. Where do you see this hierarchy of religion and spirituality in the minds and lives of these characters?
For Haitians in general, my characters, the Haitian characters in this novel, the idea is that you hold these two concepts of religion or spirituality together at once. So, you know, there's an old adage that Haitians are, I think it's something like 80% Catholic, but 100% voodoo is what people will say. So that even though you may be raised Catholic or, you know, in more recent decades in some kind of you know, Protestant or evangelist tradition, that Vodou is still part of a culture, even if you are not necessarily initiated in Vodou. And Vodou, you know, simply put, was a way for enslaved Africans to survive during enslavement, such that they fused the Christian beliefs that were imposed upon them by, you know, whomever was colonizing a territory with beliefs that they brought with them from the African continent. If, you know, somebody, you know, was told to believe in the Virgin Mary, for example, that person would become in Vodou Erzuli. And we have echoes of Erzulian village weavers in part of the dreams that some of the characters have. So it's really not antithetical to believe in both. It's simply a different way, I think, of naming different beliefs or different sources of inspiration to understand one's world.
So you come at this from a personal and authoritative kind of angle. You're from Haiti, born in Port-au-Prince. You moved to Canada at a young age, first Quebec, and then Winnipeg's French language neighborhood of St. Boniface in your teens. How did this time shape you as a writer?
Yeah, so actually my parents were working in St. Boniface. My mother at the what's now the university, I'm forgetting the full name of it. It used to be the Collège de Saint-Boniface. And my father was teaching at the Collège Louis Riel and then eventually moved to St. Mary's Academy. So we never actually lived in Saint-Boniface, but I just wanted to clarify they both worked there.
Noted.
We grew up in Winnipeg. I grew up in Winnipeg. And, you know, it's interesting because I think in Quebec, I had to, coming from an all-Black country like Haiti, I had to confront racism in a way that I had never experienced before. And then coming to Winnipeg and then being mainstreamed into English, one of the benefits in some ways of being in the prairies at a time when there were not a lot of people from Haiti is that I learned about so many other cultures. So I was hearing French and Creole at home, but my friends were also having another language at home. So it wasn't as if you were really that foreign, you know?
Right.
You could be Haitian and you could be something else. And then by the time I got to the University of Manitoba, I had the benefit of so many scholars and professors. So I received a lot in terms of thinking about how to express oneself in literature, whether as an immigrant or, you know, in terms of thinking about space. And I think for me, the confrontation is in Winnipeg was to realize that Winnipeg was not really home, even though I was growing up there. And so once I started writing about Haiti and claiming my right to write about Haiti, I think I really came into my own.
There are world-shifting events in the lives of Cece and Gertie that essentially drive them apart, like Haiti's in crisis, the rise of François Duvalier looms large, who was obviously the Haitian president at the time, who ruled with violence and imposed a reign of terror. What's happening to the world around these characters at this time?
Yeah, so like many people of their generation, they have to decide whether to stay or to leave. You know, Cece's older sister, Margie, is heavily involved in activism, and so she has to leave the country. They also witness what happens to other women who are activists or who stand for human rights or women's rights, and so they decide to leave. And Gertie, at this point, is moving more into the Dominican Republic and to Florida, so she's less aware of what is happening. And so I wanted to capture with their two trajectories the fact that not everyone experienced the regime equally or in the same ways. And part of what the characters also have to process is how to combat that violence. So Cece ends up in France, but that violence follows her because she goes there, is involved with other activist groups. You know, a friend of hers from Haiti is involved in the movement to free Algeria, but also in protecting Haitians who are trying to flee and are being pursued by the dictatorship, which is something which did happen beyond, you know, the confines of the island. And so I wanted to reflect those realities and then the hard choices that very young people, because they're, you know, in their 20s when the regime is happening, have to make. When faced with these kinds of, you know, that kind of violence, but also trying to hold on to the home they once knew, which was not this violent place, right?
Yeah.
And so Cece decides, you know, that she wants to pursue a quieter life, and she ends up in the Midwest of the United States, not unlike the prairies of Canada. And I suppose I also wanted to punctuate that sometimes that choice is what an individual must do in order to survive for themselves. Not everyone is built to be on the front lines, but that can be one way to resist or to survive.
So speaking of survival, Cece and Gertie, their friendship is tested and life takes them to Europe, the Dominican Republic, the United States, as you mentioned. Without giving too much away, what does love and longing mean for these characters?
Yeah, so what I try to explore in the novel through this connection that the characters, you know, find in childhood and then try to rebuild over their lifetime is that really love is a question of wanting the best for others. And so this is something that is explored in the novel in different ways. For example, they have a very close friend who is what in Haiti we would call M. She's a queer woman. And so she makes some harder choices about her life. She also, I have to say, has privileges. She's Italian, Haitian. She's upper class. So she has somewhat more freedoms. But she learns in some ways of her freedom through Vaudou circles and then continues that in France. But it is something that Cece watches in particular with a kind of awe, you know, because she doesn't know if she could have made that kind of choice. And then Gertie is in some ways someone who has to grapple with the kinds of impositions of colorism, classism that were imposed by her siblings, her older siblings, when she was a child. And she's still trying to work through as she becomes older. And so what I find interesting with these characters is that it's through their daughters and the love for their daughters that, and for each other, that ultimately they come full circle to understanding that love really is about wanting more for someone else than you want for yourself. But it takes them a lifetime to reach that point, as maybe it does for everyone.
Miriam, it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Same here.
Thank you.
Miriam J.A. Chancy is the author of Village Weavers. She spoke with Ryan from her home in Los Angeles. Tom Wilson is a multiple Juno winner who spent many decades touring with his bands Junk House and Blackie and the Rodeo Kings. In his memoir, Beautiful Scars, Steel Town Secrets, Mohawk Skywalkers, and The Road Home, he tells the story of discovering the truth of his birth. He was adopted, and his biological parents were Indigenous. Tom is also a longtime artist, and he's published a collection of his work called Mohawk Warriors, Hunters, and Chiefs. Here is Tom Wilson answering the next chapter's version of the Proust questionnaire.
Name your favorite writers.
Oh, my favorite writers. I'd have to say my favorite writers, artists, musicians, always are the people that opened up the doors of possibilities to me. And our jobs as people working to be artists or writers or musicians or actors is to be able to open up the door of possibilities to the next people coming through. I found in my youth, because I struggled with identity and knowing who I was, I looked to the writing of people like Bukowski and Jack Kerouac. I mean, I'm old enough to have been influenced greatly by those books. And more recently, Bob Dylan's Chronicles, which is, he writes exactly like I think I write.
If you could change something about yourself, what would it be?
I would like to get on the right medication for my ADHD. At the age of 64, I'm finding it more challenging to be able to sit down and focus. I'm in the middle of writing my second book, Blood Memory. I'm also finishing a play that opens in April. I juggle those two things along with music and along with painting. So I already have plenty of reasons to be distracted, but I get distracted by the little things. And, the way the sun kind of shines off my car keys, you know. So my focus and my attention span would be what I would improve for sure.
What phrase do you most overuse?
Anything for a buck. I remember playing a poorly attended music festival north of Kingston years ago. The opening band for the show was the Tragically Hip. Then my band from Hamilton, the Florida Razors, and another great iconic band from Hamilton called Teenage Head. And Teenage Head went out there and they gave everything they had for probably about 50 people in a field that would hold 10,000. And as Frankie Venom came off the stage, he shouted to me from across the backstage area, "Anything for a buck." I would like to change that now in my life to anything for love. And without sounding too corny, I would do anything to preserve love on this planet.
Who is your favorite painter?
Kent Monkman has managed to stir up colonial history by using colonial style art to tell the truth of the indigenous world here on Turtle Island, North America. He takes the gloves off and he kind of gives you the 1-2 punch. He makes us realize that this country is responsible for one of the greatest and inhumane attempts to wipe out a population of people in the history of man.
What is your favorite occupation?
Landscaping. I've had 3 jobs outside of the work that I do in the arts. At the age of 14, I worked on a loading dock for the Hamilton Spectator newspaper in Hamilton. That was a rough job, man. And then I also worked construction when I gave up music when I was 29 years old. But my favorite occupation was landscaping, a job I picked up for a summer, just trying to put some money together, because they drove me around in a truck. And all I had to do was cut grass, and I was stoned all day.
Where would you like to live?
Hamilton, Ontario is where I would like to live. I lived in L.A. when I was young. I lived in Halifax. I lived in Toronto. I came back to Hamilton. My daughter lives 3 blocks from me, and my 4 grandkids live 3 blocks from me. My mother lives 5 blocks from me. Everything I love, everybody that I love and that I can't live without are in Hamilton, Ontario. So I'll stick right there.
What is your idea of perfect happiness?
Creating. I've worked my entire life to get where I am. I've managed to create at times when it basically didn't pay the bills. Now what I do happily, I get to pay the bills, you know. So painting, writing, creating music, these things are what are important to me. They're my lifeblood, to be able to make something that wasn't there yesterday.
What is your greatest fear?
Losing my memories and the feelings that go with those memories. In the last 10 years, I discovered my identity, something that I was missing for 54 years before. So the fact that I know who I am and I know the land that I'm from, I know my mother now, losing my memories and losing the feelings that I have for people and for this world that we live in, that would be my greatest fear, and that would be losing my identity again.
Who are your favorite characters in history?
Rebels. Louis Riel, the true Prime Minister of Canada. What a fantastic, inspiring character he was. And besides the work he did for his community and his nations, he also said that the indigenous world would rise to the top through their artists, through the art they create. I'm paraphrasing that. But that's a good enough reason to pick him, isn't it?
Who are your favorite heroes in real life?
My children have filled in a lot of blanks for me over the years. They were the people that pushed me forward to finding my identity And they were the people who have embraced and taught me the strength of our medicines and our language. And without them pointing those things out, I probably wouldn't have been smart enough to pick up on it.
That was Tom Wilson answering the Proust questionnaire. A collection of his art has recently been published in the book Mohawk Warriors, Hunters, and Chiefs. And that is it for today's program. Jacqueline Kirk is our senior producer with Lisa Matthews. My thanks this week to Laura Antonelli, Trevor Carter, Leila Ahuman, and to the CBC Books digital team. Coming up next week, I speak with columnist Brian Francis. We'll be here with three books that offer advice on taking your foot off the gas and letting go of the hustle. And for Poetry Month, Ryan B. Patrick will speak with Dawn McDonald from her home in Whitehorse about her poetry collection, Northerny. I'm Ali Hassan. Thanks for listening to The Next Chapter.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.